The March of Time. Time, the weekly news magazine, takes you to the news fronts of the world.
Italy.
A report on Vatican policies and internal conditions.
Germany.
An eyewitness report on U.S. heavy bombing damage to enemy cities.
Russia.
Excerpts from William L. White's report on the Russians.
And from Fort Dix, New Jersey,
a demonstration of how the Army can now lay telephone wire cross-country at better than 2 miles a minute. Stand by for the March of Time.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Westbrook Van Voorhis speaking for the editors of Time magazine. East and west, the Allies this week hold some 35,000 square miles, one-fifth of Germany. As combat commanders move across the Rhine, German civilians are learning to feel the burdens of a conquered people. But it'll take more than this to undo the work of 12 Nazi years. Best hope is to re-educate German youth, and on post-Hitler schools may hang the question of a third World War. In the conquered German city of Aachen, however, a start has been made toward re-educating German youth. Tonight, the March of Time brings you a report by the correspondents of Time magazine on experiments in re-educating the youth of Aachen, Germany.
In Aachen, Germany, the war of might is over, and the war of mind is beginning. The new war of mind began when the civilian governor of Aachen, Major Hugh Jones, walked into the office of his deputy, Major Jack Bradford.
Jack, I'm dumping these in your lap.
Huh?
From now on, it's your job.
School books?
Yeah, a few for a starter. Nazi school books. See if you can salvage any of them, because you've also got 1,000 German school kids on your hands, and you've got to teach them something.
Oh, brother.
And here are some directives from Supreme Headquarters to guide you.
Major Bradford sat down with professional educational advisors sent from the U.S. to help in just such jobs as this.
1,000 kids. What are we going to do with them?
Well, the older ones can pick up rubbish, run errands.
Sure, but we've got to keep the younger ones, the ones under 10, off the streets. If we can only get the first 4 grades going, it'll be a start, but what'll we do for teachers?
Well, there were, there were 325 registered teachers here. Most of them were Nazis, and they scrammed. There are just 49 left.
All right. We'll screen them. Check, recheck them. Make sure they're fit to teach.
Okay, we're prepared for that, Major.
Yeah, but the big problem is books. We can't let them read this Nazi truck. It'd be better to leave these kids without any schools at all than to let them keep on reading about guns, soldiers, and Heil Hitler. We've got to find books published before Hitler. Where in the world can we find them?
The only full set is at Columbia University in New York.
Then let's borrow them. Go through them all, pick out the best. Send to Columbia for them.
One by one, the problems of Aachen's schools were attacked.
Of 1,200 German school books published before Hitler, just 9 were selected. 6 primers, 3 arithmetics.
German printing and German labor were prepared to publish 20,000 copies.
Of the 49 school teachers who were screened, only 26 passed their tests.
Although all Nazi schools had been closed by battle, enough were left intact to house the first 4 grades.
This week, Major Jack Bradford can report to Supreme Headquarters that Aachen's primary schools are virtually ready to open. And not a few little Nazis are due for a surprise or two when they look in their primers.
Ring around, oh Rosie. Mary had a little lamb. Oh, a soldier. 9, he has a paper hat and a wooden sword. And the arithmetic. No soldiers, no guns, just apples, oranges, and... What are bananas?
Best that can be said for the new books, perhaps, is that they are harmless. American military governors are well aware that Ring Around a Rosie and lambs are no antidote for Nazi poison. The long-range problem of re-educating German youth will be up to the Big 4 who will occupy all of Germany. But Aachen is a beginning, a proving ground. Time marches on! Just returned to the U.S. after almost 18 months in Italy, first as an ambulance driver with the American Field Service, then as Time magazine correspondent, is Tom Durance. Tonight he is at our Washington microphone to help clarify the confusing news from Italy. Italy's internal politics and wartime living conditions, and the increasing role of the Vatican in international affairs. Mr. Durance will be interviewed by Perry Cully. Come in, Washington. Go ahead, Perry Cully.
For months, Tom, we've been hearing conflicting reports about the confused political situation in Italy. Can you tell us anything that might help clear up this muddle?
Well, the real political power in Italy today, Perry, is the Vatican. Bonomi's government was born of expedience and has been fostered ever since by the Allies as a buffer between the Italian left and right. Ever since, it has drifted in confusion and general frustration. It hasn't won the confidence of the Italian people or the respect of the outside world. But during this period, the Vatican has been hard at work. It has made great efforts to overcome the ill feeling that had developed against the church since the beginning of the war. The Vatican and even the Pope himself had been accused of assuming too passive a role in the struggle against fascism. Of course, most of the condemnations and accusations came from Moscow. But until very recently, the Vatican's official organ, the Osservatore Romano, was answering Radio Moscow almost daily. For the first time in modern history, the Vatican was actually engaged in open, heated argument with another nation. Now, however, by a most astute series of political and diplomatic maneuvers, the Pope has convinced Moscow, and it must be remembered that the Pope himself took the initiative, that understanding and good relations between the Vatican and the Kremlin are not impossible. The final stages of this important agreement are now in progress. It is believed that after a series of conferences with Archbishop Francis Spellman and Mr. Ed Flynn, the Vatican will have made its peace with Russia. Further, by calling on the U.S. in this crisis, it will have succeeded in rallying American public opinion. The negotiations between the Vatican and Kremlin, if they are completely successful, might be called a masterpiece of diplomacy.
That would be fine, Tom. But on a long-term basis, it'd be good for Italy. How about the present? Conditions were bad when I saw you last summer in Rome, and we hear they're getting worse. Is that true?
Conditions are very bad, Perry, and they'll be even worse until after the final peace. Thievery and black marketing are everywhere. Naples, for instance, is a hotbed of all types of crime. And Rome, for all its beautiful, broad, tree-lined avenues, its sprawling government buildings, which in many ways remind me of Washington, is now the headquarters for scores of tough, well-armed thieves. Deserters from the British and American armies have joined the most desperate elements of the Italian lower class and have thrown the city into a panic of fear. Civilians go home by sundown. Soldiers on leave are warned not to roam the streets alone. Almost every night you can hear the crack of pistol shots as the Italian carabinieri and military police shoot it out with thieves, rapists, and murderers. Just before I left Rome a few days ago, I was awakened about 2 a.m. by the crack of a .45 in the street below my window, which overlooks Via Veneto, the Park Avenue of Rome. The MP standing guard at the hotel entrance had discovered 7 Italian civilians stealing the tires from a Jeep, which was parked less than 40 feet away. Tires bring $1,000 each these days on the Rome black market. The Italians and the Allied Control Commission are trying to better the situation. But it's a tough job. The Italians are unhappy. And the trial of General Rovada, the man who escaped so fantastically a few days ago, was viewed by most Romans as typical of the entire bitterly laughable situation. The Italians will not be satisfied until they're allowed to participate more fully in the war. They don't want to be looked upon as a mere co-belligerent. They want to be allies. Italy wants, most of all, to be admitted once again to the status of a free, independent, and highly regarded nation.
Thank you, Tom Durance and Perry Cully. In this scientific war, as in no other, victory depends on speed of movement, and above all, on speed of communications. Therefore, the past 3 years have seen unprecedented developments in communications in our armed forces. In radar, radio, and that faithful standby, the telephone. Most of these developments, growing out of constant scientific experiment by the armed forces in cooperation with American industry, must, of course, remain secret. But tonight, the march of time is able to bring you detailed news of one of the most amazing developments of them all. The telephone has grown wings and taken to the air. After many months of preparation and testing, the Air Communications Officer, the Air Technical Service Command, and Bell Laboratories have perfected a way of laying telephone wire across the country by airplanes in full flight. The march of time now takes you to Fort Dix, New Jersey, to hear a demonstration of this new technique for the first time on the air. Within 5 minutes, by your watch, A twin-engine C-47 will lay 8 miles of telephone wire across open country. Within the same 5 minutes, telephone communications will be set up between 2 points separated by those 8 miles of telephone wire, and a call completed. The demonstration will be directed by Captain R.R. Ford of the Equipment Laboratory of Wright Field, Ohio, world headquarters of the Air Technical Service Command. Captain Ford is now standing by at a March of Time microphone at Fort Dix, New Jersey. Come in, Fort Dix. Go ahead, Captain Ford.
I am now standing before a microphone placed near the main landing field at Fort Dix, New Jersey. A twin-engine C-47 is overhead and about to fly over this spot in a few seconds. Please consult your watches and note the exact moment the plane passes over us here. One of our officers, Captain Lumpkin, is up in the plane, ready to drop one end of the telephone wire with which the plane is loaded. Here with me is a ground crew of 2 men with a regulation Army field telephone set, waiting for the wire to hit the ground. One end of it has just been thrown from the plane, attached to a 36-inch parachute and a 20-pound weight. The cloud is flown accurately over us at about 125 miles an hour at an altitude of only 200 feet. The little parachute has dropped the wire on the ground less than 100 feet from where I stand. My ground crew have run over to it and are attaching clips to the wire. In that way, the field telephone right here beside me is hooked in. In a few seconds, I will be able to talk to Captain Lumpkin in the plane over this telephone and over the wire as it is being laid out of the plane. Several miles away from us here, across open country, Sergeant John Linfesty and another ground crew are waiting for the other end of the 8 miles of wire.
Are you ready yet, Captain Lumpkin?
Yes, Captain Ford. Can you hear me all right now?
I hear you perfectly, Captain. Is everything working all right?
Yes, sir.
Please describe the interior of your plane, Captain, and how the wire is feeding out.
Here in the fuselage of the C-47, we have a number of containers of telephone wire. They are lined up across the cargo floor. All the containers are connected together, and each one holds 2 miles of wire. That means we have enough wire to lay 16 miles if we need to.
Captain, will you please describe how the wire feeds out of the plane?
From the container nearest the open doorway, there is a short tube reaching outside the body of the plane. The wire feeds through that tube, outside the plane, and down to ground. We are now flying at 120 miles an hour, and the wire is feeding from containers and across the open country below us at 200 feet per second, or 2 miles a minute. Everything is going okay, sir.
All right, Captain. I will talk to you again in a few seconds. Stand by.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here with me is Paul W. Bly, transmission engineer of Bell Telephone Laboratories. Mr. Bly.
The wire-laying system being demonstrated tonight is the product of more than a year's research by Bell Telephone Laboratories for the Army Air Forces. The problem of uncoiling wire smoothly without snarls or breaks at speeds over 200 feet per second required considerable study and experiment. After extensive laboratory tests, we set up a field laboratory here at Fort Dix Air Base, and over 200 flight tests were carried out. Finally, we were able to lay 16 miles of wire over the Great Smoky Mountains in 6 2/3 minutes. We expect that this technique will save many lives on our fighting fronts, and it may have important peacetime uses also when floods or other natural disasters wipe out regular telephone lines. And now, here is Captain Ford again.
Thank you, Mr. Bly. I'm now going to talk to Captain Lumpkin in the C-47 again. Captain Lumpkin?
Yes, Captain Ford.
Are you nearing your target area?
Yes, sir. We'll drop the end of the wire as we cross the clearing where Sergeant Linfesty and his men are waiting. The telephone connection we are now using will be automatically severed. All right, sir. Here it goes.
The end of the line has just been dropped from Captain Lumpkin's plane at the other end of 8 miles of telephone wire from here. At this moment, Sergeant Linfesty and his ground crew are clipping his field telephone into the line. Are you plugged in yet, Sergeant? No answer yet. While this is a radio demonstration, let me emphasize that there is no microphone anywhere near Sergeant Linfesty and his men.
Only the field telephone. Captain Ford calling Sergeant Linfesty.
Ready, sir.
Did everything work out all right, Sergeant?
Yes, Captain Ford. It only took us 20 seconds to plug in this telephone after the wire hit the ground. How long ago was the wire dropped at your end, sir?
By my watch, Sergeant, it was a little over 4 minutes ago.
Captain, it's really a tough job to string telephone wire through jungle country in a hurry. In one recent case in the Asiatic theater, 41 men in a wire-laying detail were killed or wounded by snipers in only one sector. With this aerial wire-laying, we could do the same thing in only a few minutes, and what's more important, without losing the life of a single American soldier.
Thank you, Sergeant Linfesty. This completes our demonstration of the flying telephone and aerial wire-laying in exactly 4 minutes and 20 seconds. We believe that the telephone, earthbound for 50 years, has sprouted its first wings.
Time marches on.
Tonight, perhaps at this very moment, as American Marines search the rocky caves of a barren little island in the Pacific, they may be identifying the paunchy body of a certain Japanese general who recently foretold his own end. He is Tadamichi Kurabayashi, defender of Iwo Jima. And last week, Radio Tokyo quoted him as saying,
"This island is the front line that defends our mainland, and I am going to die here."
With the U.S. Marines who erased this front line, and probably Tadamichi too, is Times' Robert Sherrod. Sherrod has been with our Marines on Iwo Jima ever since they first swarmed ashore on February 19th. For 25 days, he's eyewitnessed the most bitter fighting in Marine Corps history. And his dispatches from the very scene of the fighting have helped millions of time readers here at home understand just what kind of a violent, stubborn, unremitting warfare we're having to fight in the Pacific. There are time correspondents like Bob Sherrod on every news front of the world, and on the home front as well as the war fronts. Their first-hand reports of what is happening everywhere pour in hourly, help Times editors give Times readers the sight and the sound and feel of each week's history-making events. In Times home offices, Times editors sift and weigh these reports, fit them together with the news from other sources, check and recheck them. And then they write the finished product into Time as one straight, clear, connected story that makes the news of the week make sense. That is why more than a million busy, well-informed American families now turn to Time each week for the kind of news report they can find nowhere else. American arms have captured Cologne, largest German city yet to fall. First and longest victim of Allied saturation bombing. American soldiers who entered the city, as well as those at home who saw the pictures, were stunned at the devastation wrought to what was once one of Europe's proudest cities. By this evidence, they know that many other cities inside Germany, citadels of German war-making power, must be equally flattened. After more than 3 years of war, those men in the U.S. Army Air Forces who had long preached the doctrine of long-range heavy bombardment felt that they were vindicated. Tonight, one of those men, Major General Orville Anderson, is at the March of Time's home microphone. Deputy Commander for Operations for the U.S. 8th Air Force, he has returned just this week from German soil and will report to you on the special role heavy airstrikes have played in the Allied Western Front offensives in the past 2 months. General Anderson.
Our strategic air forces are now in the final phases of the air war over Europe. Our first job was the defeat of the German Air Force, and thereafter to maintain an effective air supremacy over any area in Europe where we chose to operate. We have done that effectively, though it must be remembered that our air war with Germany involved frequent air battles whenever they elected to oppose us. Today, our main job is to aid in the complete and final destruction of the German war machine. To do this, we have three top priority targets on our list. The first and foremost important is oil and fuel. Without oil, the Germans cannot fly their planes or drive their vehicles into combat. Oil has been a top priority target since April 1944, and we have knocked the German oil production capacity down to less than 20% of what it was before our attacks began. Second on our priority list is communications. Every time our reconnaissance or fighter aircraft report a large mass of German transport tied up in a marshaling yard, such as Dresden, Chemnitz, or Cottbus, which are communication bottlenecks on the Russian front, these targets are marked for special attention, and suitable task forces of heavy bombers of the 8th Air Force are promptly dispatched to effect their destruction. It matters little to us if the target is on the East Front or the West. It's all one war to us, and if we help the Russians by knocking out German communications on their front, we are helping end the war that much quicker. Any suitable marshaling yard or communication center is top priority on our target list. With the marginal effort that is left after we have finished working over fuel and communications targets, we include attacks from all levels on appropriate war industries. The multiple system of marshaling yards and specific war industries in Cologne represent typical targets for our attack. Plane and tank factories and producers of other vehicles receive our constant attention. But the war has gone so well that we also strike at other good targets, whether they be ammunition train, ordnance depot, or other military supply concentrations. In this connection, I think I can say without violating security that many German strategic reserves appear now to be critically short. This has been particularly noticed on our attacks on Germany's strategic oil depots. Over many of the targets which we have hit in the past, we were able to get explosions and see dense smoke. Now our bombs kick up nothing but dust. We have the German now where he cannot currently meet his fuel requirements, either in the air or on the ground. And our most important job is to keep him that way. Because of progress now being made on the ground, for the rest of the war, we must continue to place high priority for bombing against supply and transport concentrations intended for early use by German frontline troops. The purpose of these attacks is to shorten the war by totally immobilizing the German war effort, by destroying German supplies and production, thus making the conquest of Germany easier for the British, Russian, and American land armies.
Thank you, General Orville Anderson. Published today is a new and provocative book on the Soviet Union. So provocative, in fact, that even before publication, it provoked this snarl from Moscow's Pravda.
This book is the usual stew from the fascist kitchen, with all its smells, lies, ignorance, and hidden anger. Its author is a certain shady newsboy named White.
The book, Report on the Russians. The author, no shady newsboy. He is a distinguished American author and journalist named William Lindsay White of Emporia, Kansas. Bill White went through the London Blitz and the First Finnish War, and he's written such memorable books as They Were Expendable and Journey for Margaret. White's new book, Report on the Russians, covers his six-week tour of Russia last summer with Eric Johnston, president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Of Bill White and his book, says Time magazine,
Report on the Russians is an honest, highly personal account of how the Russians, whom he liked, and the Soviet system, which he disliked, looked to a seasoned newsman who has seen a lot of the world but kept the basic viewpoint of his native Kansas.
Tonight, the March of Time brings you a few typical scenes from Report on the Russians. Things Bill White liked and things he disliked. His welcome to Moscow occurred a few days before the Normandy invasion last June. At a luncheon, Bill White sat next to a fox-faced Russian who filled their vodka glasses.
Come, Mr. White. We drink to the Second Front, eh?
The Second Front? Well, that was over long ago.
Oh, no. It is even now in the newspapers that there will soon be one, perhaps.
Oh, in capitalist countries, the fronts aren't numbered as they are here.
Well, how do you say, then?
Well, the First Front was when Poland fell. The Second Front was in 1940, when France fell. You were neutral. The Third Front is the invasion of Yugoslavia and Greece. Again, you were neutral. The next front is when Hitler attacks the Soviet Union. We were very sorry. But for us, it was the fourth front. The fifth front is when Japan attacks America. Here again, you are neutral. The sixth front is when we land in North Africa, and the seventh front is when we landed in Italy.
But anyway, we drink to the new front. For you, the eighth, to me, the second front.
In Leningrad, Eric Johnston and Bill White are escorted through an electrical plant by its director, Gregory Mukhin.
In this part of our plant, we are assembling small electric motors. We have 250 people employed in this division, Mr. Johnston.
Yeah, nice little motors. They look just about like a standard model we have back home.
You make that kind in your factory in Spokane, Eric?
Yeah, Bill. Sell for $55.
The 250 workers in this division turn out 400 motors a month. They receive an equivalent of about $88 a month for their work.
Uh-huh. Well, let's do a little figuring. 400 motors, $55, bringing a monthly total of about $22,000. And if the sum is divided equally among the 250 workers, yes, they would indeed get $88 a month.
That is so.
But that doesn't leave anything for factory overhead or the wages of management or even the cost of material, does it?
Concludes Correspondent White.
Is it unskilled management or unskilled labor? Whatever the answer, the picture is the same in almost every plant we visit. This factory is also badly lit and dirty.
In Moscow, Bill White is a guest of honor at one of the innumerable Russian banquets. Beside him sits Jenny, the young Russian interpreter. Young Bill rises to give his expected and also one of the innumerable toasts. Jenny is ready to translate for him.
All set, Jenny?
Yes, Mr. White.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am here not as a representative of American business, but rather as an American writer and representing her free press. All right, Jenny, translate.
Not yet, Mr. White. Go on.
But, Jenny,
Go on.
Why don't you translate what I said about the free American press?
You should know such a thing is forbidden in the Soviet Union.
Writes William White.
There is one marked difference between inmates of the Soviet Union and of the Kansas State Penitentiary. Food and clothing in both places is about the same, maybe a little better in Lansing, Kansas. In Russia, a talented inmate can work himself up to be a warden, which would be impossible in Lansing. The way to understand capitalism is not to memorize the long words economists use, is to go someplace where they don't have any and see what they do instead.
On the other hand, White believes the Red Army is good, that Russians are fine farmers, and the Russian attitude toward minority races is intelligently decent. Just before leaving Russia, White was a guest at a banquet in one of Russia's distant Mongolian republics, Kazakh. After entertainment by native dancers and musicians, White relaxes. One of the Russian hosts got up for a toast.
We hope you have enjoyed our artists of Kazakh. They are taking their place in the great artistic world of the Soviet Union. They have gone to the front to entertain Red Army soldiers. I propose a toast to the artists of Kazakh. And now, Mr. White.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am surprised and pleased to learn that Soviet artists entertain at the front. I'm sorry I know so little about all they're doing in the war, but I didn't know it. And perhaps there are many things that American artists are doing that you don't know. Our artists are taken by plane thousands of miles out into desolate Pacific islands or across the Atlantic at the camps in Italy and France to sing to our soldiers the old tunes of our homeland. And I remember the British artists during the 1940 Blitz when both Russia and America were neutral. The British artists came out to the airfields and gave the best the English people had. Now, we in America have a morale problem which doesn't exist in the Soviet Union. Russia was invaded, and every Red soldier knew that he was fighting for his own home soil. But no invader set foot on American soil. Yet, we sent our boys thousands of miles away to oppose fascist aggressors in a war which many of us thought we need not enter. Is it any wonder that these lonely, homesick men ask themselves why they were being sent to die capturing islands and cities whose names they'd never heard of? So, all the more need to give them our best to cheer their loneliness, to prove their own people had not forgotten them. I offer a toast to the artists of all Allied nations.
Thus, the emotions and the findings of reporter Bill White of Emporia, Kansas, as he traveled Russia, witnessing the great Russian social experiment in wartime. Time marches on.
Every afternoon at this same network, at 4 o'clock Eastern Wartime, listen to another program prepared by the editors and correspondents of Time magazine. Time views the news. And next Thursday evening at the same time, listen again to The March of Time.
This is the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company.